Yesterday, Gil offered the image of the nuns in Burma, walking by the meditation hall, and 500 women, 500 nuns, and the dignity and the stillness as one beautiful expression of samadhi. There's another image that I sometimes think of, which is when I was a college student, I spent almost a year abroad at Oxford in England. And for some reason, I thought it would be a good idea to join the rowing team. And, I think it was a bunch of us Americans, and we, kind of had a team and with some of the native students. And the image that comes to mind is, after a lot of practice and a lot of effort, getting all of us to coordinate, and all of the movements being in harmony, all the parts working together. And just this beautiful, there's something to me about samadhi in that. The power and the grace and the speed of just, this symphony, everything happening together, the harmony of it. So as Gil said, samadhi is usually translated as concentration. But in a way, that word doesn't capture fully the richness of samadhi. Sometimes we talk about it as unification, as in unifying the body and mind. So when the body and the mind are in the same place at the same time doing the same thing, that's a kind of samadhi. Samadhi can develop. So you can have samadhi for chopping the carrots, samadhi in any kind of activity. Other words I like to use: stillness, clarity. Collecting the mind, gathering the mind. And so here on retreat, as we begin to settle, we start to notice. One of the things that we might notice is the ways that we feel fragmented, various kinds of inner conflict can start to surface. The most basic being the body is here and the mind is somewhere else, in the past or the future. And another really basic one is simply the conflict between how things are and how we want them to be. Just that fundamental resistance. So in thinking about that, samadhi is a kind of non-conflict, non-struggle. And to be able to let go of that struggle, let go of that resistance, is what brings a tremendous sense of ease, of peacefulness, of healing. People often report that states of samadhi feel incredibly healing. putting us in touch with a kind of wholeness that we long for. So there's one story of two monks. This is kind of a contemporary story, but I'm anonymizing it. The two monks who were, having some conflict or difficulty, and one of the monks went to the master and, complained about the other monk who was taking food or something. And the first monk was the cook, someone was getting into the kitchen, taking food. And the master, all the master said was, to see virtue, you have to have a calm mind. To see clearly, to see goodness, we need a mind that's calm. We need a mind that's peaceful. When the water isn't stirred up and agitated, we can see through it. So I think what this points to is interesting in that it's a simple thing that I think we all know, but it's easy to forget, which is that what we perceive is itself conditioned. I think there's an expression like what we see, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. That kind of idea. And the idea with meditation and with samadhi is the more still the mind gets, the more it can perceive, the more accurately it can perceive. And what it perceives is change. What it perceives is impermanence. What it perceives is the inconstancy of things. When our mind moves around a lot, things feel very solid, very I know this with myself when I travel often between Japan and the US, and I know not to make decisions or have important conversations when I'm really jet lagged. Because I get off the plane, I'm really tired and a little bit cranky. and then everything seems a little dark, a little negative, and things seem really fixed. Some little thing that's wrong with the house, it's like, oh no. But when the mind is very calm, very still, very clear, then we see, we see more accurately, we see the lightness of things. And so the Buddha said, one who cultivates samadhi sees things as they are. And the other thing just to say about samadhi is that it's a training. It's one of the trainings, and it's there's a progression to it. Just as we can train our body and make our muscles stronger, it's possible to train the mind. Often it's the analogy is given to a puppy. And the puppy just wants to go, wherever it wants to go. But by continually bringing it back, eventually the puppy learns to stay. It learns to stay with you. And that's really great because then you can have fun. Then you can walk with the puppy and you're not worried that the puppy's going to go different places, and he kind of stays with you and listens to you. And, you know, so it's like turning the mind into an ally. And so samadhi has this power. I thought to say a little bit about the relationship between mindfulness and concentration, because we use these words, you know, and it can get a little bit confusing. So the way I think about it is mindfulness is the knowing quality of the mind. You know, it's you know, it's that capacity to know, that capacity to pay attention. And it takes almost no effort. You know, it's like if you... You know, just the effort to know the sound. You know, there's almost no effort at all. But what takes effort is to remember, to... you know, is the continuity of it, is staying with it. It's, you know, we're so conditioned to cut out, to cut away. So mindfulness is the knowing quality, knowing what you're doing when you're doing it. And then moments of mindfulness strung together is what constitutes samadhi, you know. So moment to moment to moment to moment, you're with the sensations of the breath, or with the body, or feeling a sensation, or listening. And that is how we build samadhi. So, and then, I had this idea today after, you know, participating in the practice discussions, to talk a little bit about what I see as two sides of meditation. The receptive side and then the active side. So there's one way of approaching meditation that is kind of like a radical receptivity. It's like, the way I think about it is opening all the doors and windows of a house and just letting everything come in, letting everything come through. It's allowing an unedited version of ourselves, you know, or an uncensored version of ourselves. And this is a very different way of being than how we are in relationship with people, how we are in the world. And so it's... it's actually not that... It's actually difficult to do. It's not that easy to do. One of my teachers compares this in a way to Freud's exercise with free association, you know, and the idea with free association, my understanding is that it's an exercise that's designed to see, to show us where where we hold back, where we censor ourselves, you know. So the person says house, and I say roof. They say dog, I say cat. They say mother, I say you know, you know. And you know, so there's, but as we get familiar with this way of being, this way of letting things come and go, just receiving, there's something about it that's very satisfying, that can be very satisfying. Um, And even what I'm calling this receptivity is supported by something that's active. It's supported by our body. It's supported by our posture. It's supported by the kind of willingness to be open, but not follow, you know, not be seduced by our thinking, by our emotions, to kind of be a witness, to be an impartial witness. So anyway, that's one way I think of the receptive part, the radical acceptance, radical receptivity. So and then there's this active side of meditation, which is choosing where to place the mind. You know, it's choosing what to attend to. And so yesterday Gil mentioned the five factors of samadhi, the five jhanic factors. And the first two are the ones that, you know, I want to talk about a little bit. These are considered the active side of meditation. So the first one is, the Pali word is vitakka. So this is the mental factor that directs the mind onto the object. It's like the word I use to kind of shorthand for this factor is connecting, to connect. So we're sitting, you know, we're here, we're open, we're relaxed, we're listening. And then we have the idea, oh, I'll check in with the breath. And it's like that connecting to the sensations of the breath is vitakka. It's the factor of mind that applies the attention to something. And then the second one is vichara, which is sustaining the attention on the object. So, you know, it's one thing to connect to the breath in a moment, and it's another thing to stay with the breath, to follow the whole exhalation, and then the pause, and then the inhalation. So that's vichara. So connecting and sustaining. Sometimes you use the word touching and touching and rubbing, or touching and polishing. It's like the mind is polishing the object. I mentioned in the opening circle that I have two daughters, and our youngest baby is about 9 months, and she's not talking yet. I mean, she makes, you know, noises, and we often carry her in the carrier. And sometimes I'll notice if I'm preoccupied with something, or, you know, talking to someone or looking at my phone. And then I kind of feel there's someone looking at me, and then, you know, and I look down, and she's looking up at me like that. And there's this, you know, if anyone's been around babies, I mean, you know this, it's like this great moment of catching each other's eyes, you know, and this connection. And it's just there's the energy in this, so, you know, connect. And then to hold that, you know, to hold that connection, that, something is alive and something is moving and it's communicated. So it's connecting and sustaining. So Gil talks about the example of the bird, you know, spreading the wings, flapping the wings to start flying, is vitakka, is applying, is connecting, is the effort. And then gliding on open wings is vichara, is sustaining, is the continuous contact. Another example that's used is if you're going to polish a metal bowl, the touching of the bowl is vitaka, you know, the kind of, and then the rubbing, the polishing is vichara. So as I'm sure you've discovered, to employ these factors, especially to connect, you know, it takes a certain kind of effort. It takes a certain kind of diligence, you know, to counter the forces of preoccupation and over again come back, over and over again connect. And, you know, so something about understanding the value of it and not being discouraged, being willing to, you know, connect again and again, and you know, just in a simple way, it can be very, very helpful for the meditation. And I think it's important to say that we can connect with anything. It's not just like this applies to the breath. One of the, you know, if the principle of meditation, if the principle of samadhi is not to be in conflict, it doesn't make sense to try to pull the mind to the breath when something else is very compelling. So, you know, a strong emotion, for example. So in that case, we turn and we apply this towards the emotion. We apply it towards the, you know, physical sensation or whatever is happening. And then the vichara to stay, you can see if this is true for you, but it's definitely true for me, that it's much easier to stay with something that's pleasant, you know, to stay with something that's pleasurable. And that's one of the reasons that we often suggest, see if there's a way that you can adjust the breath, you know, that makes it slightly more pleasurable, because that makes it easier to stay with it. It turns out that it's much easier to be absorbed into something that's pleasant, something that's pleasurable. The classic example for this is going to the movies, you know. And it's, you know, someone who says, oh yeah, I do meditation retreats and I never get concentrated, can quite easily go to a film and be very absorbed in the story and the characters and the drama and the, you know, you just lose yourself in the experience. So our minds want to do this. Our minds know how to do this. So it's easiest to say when it's pleasant, when it's pleasurable, and also when there's an element of curiosity or interest. And so this is where it's like, you know, to become curious in the experience of the breath, to become curious and interested in the sensations that are making up our experience of our body, is extremely helpful for the meditation. And then you might notice this interesting dynamic of the interplay between the mind and the mind object, what the mind is noticing. not only is the mind kind of polishing the breath, but as we connect and as we stay, the breath starts to polish the mind. And through applying these factors and through staying with the object, the mind itself becomes brighter. You know, the mindfulness itself becomes sharper, more alert, more aware. You know, maybe this familiar to some of you, this feeling. And so Gil today talked about the concentric circles. And so in a way, I see that the receptive aspect of the meditation is this really wide circle, you know, the really wide. And then, you know, so it's possible in meditation to bring these together, the active and the receptive. And so starting with the widest possible, you know, holding it all. And then, you know, a gentle directedness, you know, simplifying on the breath. And just to say a few more things, retreat practice itself is not linear. You know, we know this. You know, it's not like, you know, every sitting, every, you know, samadhi just builds and builds and builds and builds and builds and builds in this linear way. So I think one of the great insights for retreat practice is is developing some ease and equanimity around the ups and downs of the retreat. You know, one sitting is calm and concentrated, and the next sitting, you know, whether walking, whatever, may be more stirred up, more agitated. And once we see this pattern over and over, it starts to be more okay, you know, and this idea of, you know, sometimes it's one way, sometimes it's another way. And so I think there's a lot of wisdom in that, you know, and the ease with which we can move between these different circles. You know, sometimes it feels really close, it feels really intimate to be with the breath in a simple, easy way, and it's, you know, we're really in the center. We're building that strong center. And then sometimes we have to just keep moving out and out and out and holding it and holding and holding something that seems so big and so difficult and so overwhelming. So anyway, just thought to say that. And then, and if these factors seem helpful, or if this seems like something to try in the meditation, you know, connecting and sustaining, touching and holding, touching and polishing, to do it with a lot of friendliness, a lot of kindness. It's always a little bit tricky to give directions, you know. Because meditation isn't a kind of recipe that you can just, you know, put in a cup of this and a spoonful of that. So just to hold it with, you know, a lot of ease and be willing to switch between the active and the receptive. That's part of the art of meditation, you know, is knowing when, you know, it's balancing effort and ease. You know, sometimes we say it's total effort and it's total ease. And then the other thing just to say about these two qualities is that they have a wonderful relevance to our life beyond meditation and beyond retreat. You know, if you think about how wonderful it feels to be seen, how wonderful it feels to kind of be, to be acknowledged, to be seen, to be known. In building these qualities, we're cultivating our ability to do that. And so we offer that, you know, to ourselves, and we offer that to the people in our lives. It's a beautiful gift. You know, I see with my children, just to kind of, you know, just to get on the floor with them and look at them and just be with them is the best thing, you know, is just to, the willingness to connect and hold that connection, you know, not turn away, not, you know, check the phone or do this or do that. It's like, you know, to just to be with another person in that way is a beautiful thing, I think. So you know, it's a gift, and you know, it's something we're giving to ourselves, and we're growing our capacity to do that. Does anyone have any questions or anything that this brings up for you, or something that feels important to say?
I'd like to ask you, sometimes I keep my attention in the breath, and there is a strong pain, but I keep focusing on the breath, and in a way I am like ignoring there's a pain, and then the pain becomes stronger. But I keep focusing on in the breath, then I don't know, because sometimes something starts happening, and if I keep focusing my attention in the breath, there's an emotion. But this emotion doesn't has to do with the pain, because it's a kind of excitement or like feeling good in spite of the pain. But I don't pay a lot of attention to the pain or to the emotion. I just keep focusing in the breath. And something happens, because I don't need to move. I don't feel like I have to move. I feel the pain, but it's like it doesn't have to do with me anymore, because I am experiencing something better. I don't know how to explain, but should I leave the breath and focus my attention on the pain or on the emotion? Because I am having a strong sensation, a strong emotion, and at the same time, I am paying attention to the breath. sorry to explain, but am I doing it right or?
The sensation is a physical pain, and then it's a physical pain, and then there's an emotion that comes up as well,
yes,
and then.
And it's not in accordance because, well, if I am concentrated, then I don't have aversion to the pain. If I'm not concentrated, then I will have aversion. Then I try to keep on the breath. To keep on the breath.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Did everyone hear the question? So what I would say is, if you're able to stay with the breath in a relaxed way, it's okay to stay with the breath, you know. But if it's a kind of using the breath as a way of avoiding other things, then that may not be as helpful. You know, first to say there are different styles of meditation, ways of working with the breath, ways of using the breath in meditation. What we've been, kind of the instructions we've been giving here, is using the breath as an anchor, you know, so it helps us, it keeps us in the present moment. But if something else comes up that's compelling, you know, we're willing to turn towards it, willing to turn away from the breath. But there are forms of meditation that where the request is to stay with the breath only, and, you know, and keep that single focus. So there's a style of meditation that's, you know, and that's at certain times in practice, that's very valuable to learn how to do that. The danger in just staying with the breath is that we might be able to bypass something that would actually be more helpful for us to see, to look at. So if there's a strong emotion that comes up, the principle is that there's a reason for that. You know, there's something... Something is calling us. Something needs to be seen, to be listened to be acknowledged. And if we're just like with the breath, and it's nope, 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 you know, we may be building some samadhi on the breath, and that's good. But we're refusing that opportunity, you know, to let something in that wants, or let something out, actually. You know, it wants to, often emotions want to move through us and come out. So, you know, just to look at that and, you know, maybe explore, you know, see what it's like to let go of the breath if an emotion gets very strong and turn towards the emotion. But it's not like there's some rule, you know, it's more like guided by your wisdom. And then the other principle is just all of this is greatly aided by a sense of relaxation, a sense of ease, well-being. It doesn't really work to kind of, you know, the problem is it almost works. You know, to kind of bear down and just really force it and force the breath and just stay with the breath. And, you know, it sort of works for a little while, but it doesn't really work. So keeping that relaxation and is a really good, you know, way of checking in. You know, if it's relaxed and you're able to stay with the breath, you know, great. Yeah. But I, you know, in my own practice and in you know, the teaching that I'm beginning to do, I have more and more respect for our emotions, you know, emotional life, and just how powerful that is, how important it is to be valued, to be respected, you know, honored in a way as a, you know, in the meditation. And so, I don't know if that. Yeah. Well, gliding is easy, but in order to glide, we've got to flap those wings and right, you know, and get up there. And so it's like there's once we get momentum going, you know, there's, you know, it's like anything. It's like it takes initial effort to get something going. And that's the hardest, you know, I think, is that, you know, for most of us, is the most difficult thing, is like, is that continually connecting, continually coming back. And then, you know, at some point, it's not that we just coast and forget about everything, but, you know, we're working with the wind or with the gravity or something, and we're going down. So, but even when we apply effort, can there be some ease around that? You know, so it's, you know, just in a simple way, connecting, not in a kind of, I have to do this. And, you know. Beautiful, beautiful. Did everyone hear that? Yeah. And you were mindful, I mean, and you were using thought, but in a very wise way, you know, of kind of to using thought to neutralize thought, you know, in a way that's, you know, that's often what we do with the noting practice, where we're using the thought of rising or falling or something to kind of occupy the mind. And that sounds very good, very skillful. And thank you. Yeah.
Correctly. And I'm thinking about early on, well, you answered one question already, but what I'm thinking about with that is, let's say joy comes up. You're breathing, all of a sudden, great bliss, joy. And so you turn towards that. And at what point are we distinguishing clinging? Because once it's pleasant, it's nice to hang out there rather than, you know, with the unpleasant, sort of want to get away from it sometimes. I'm just wondering where clinging comes into all that.
Yeah.
As opposed to being in a state of samadhi without an attachment or clinging to it.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Did everyone hear that? So it's said that one of the hazards of doing too much samadhi practice is we start to get attached to the joy and the bliss and the so, you know, just in the big picture, the purpose for samadhi is to as the ground for insight to arise. It's not so, you know, although, you know, it has a value in itself. It's you know, it's just it's a tool, my understanding of samadhi is there's a progression and a deepening of it, which involves letting go. So, as samadhi deepens, what was joyful and blissful starts to be feel coarse. So as the mind becomes more refined, it just naturally lets go of that. So, you know, the instruction is not to be afraid of joy, not to be afraid of bliss, you know, enjoy it, go with it. And you'll know, or a teacher will help you kind of, you know. Yeah, yeah, in a way, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like one spoon of ice cream tastes good. But then if someone says, okay, you like that, well, you have to eat all of this, you know, and then it's like, oh, you know, it doesn't taste so good anymore, you know, after eating a few gallons of it. You know, the same thing with the bliss or the joy, you know, it's as you know, as we start to, as the mind gets more refined, you know, just, the pull of that becomes less, you know, and the mind moves on to more refined experiences.
I'm sure I missed something. How is, you used the word samadhi practice, how is samadhi practice different from mindfulness practice?
Yeah, I try. So I mean, one of the things I said was that kind of samadhi is made up of mindfulness, right? It's made up of mindful moments. So the more, as our mindfulness develops and becomes more continuous and more mature, this factor of samadhi arises, the factor of samadhi can deepen. And then it's like, in a way, mindfulness and samadhi become partners. The reason I'm hesitating is just because there's so many different interesting things to say about it, but the idea, basic idea, is for a balanced practice, we need the faculty of samadhi, but we also need the mindfulness, the insight, the seeing. The way I think about it is like the samadhi element is the stabilizing element. It's like, you know, it's like the way a table is stable. And then, so you've got the stability of the table, and then a microscope, to look through the microscope and to see, is the vipassana. Did that you know, we call this the insight retreat center. We don't call it the samadhi retreat center. You know, and that's, you know, that's a, you know, important to, there are practices or traditions where samadhi is the goal. And
that's
Yes. So there are traditions where samadhi is the goal, and the goal is to really cultivate these states of concentration. Our goal here, if we can say that, is to cultivate insight. You know, is to really see and because that's what frees us, that's what opens the mind. That said, samadhi is a tool, you know, which helps us to cultivate insight. Samadhi's the basis, the ground. So we need samadhi. We need some samadhi. There was another thing I wanted to say. And there are times in our practice, you know, when we'll want to focus on, you know, just cultivating that skill, cultivating the samadhi. And there are times we want to, you know, cultivate loving kindness or other things. So it's one of the things to cultivate. If that makes sense, for balanced practice. We can talk more about it. Yeah. Okay, Brian, maybe last one. Did everyone hear that? Just kind of the difference in how the instructions for mindfulness and for samadhi. What I would say is this is a mindfulness retreat with a focus on samadhi. If this were a samadhi retreat, you know, and there are, even in the, you know, Spirit Rock, you know, you go on samadhi retreats, the instructions are a little bit different because the instructions are more like, if you're working with the breath, for example, it would just be, it's staying with the breath, and then the function of mindfulness is more of noticing when you've gone off to something else, and then just coming right back to the breath. So it's like that single-pointed focus on one object. I think what we're suggesting here is giving a preference to the breath. You know, it's like the breath is the thread, you know, that, you know, so it's cultivating, you know, some degree of one-pointedness, some degree of stability with the breath. And, but allowing, you know, other compelling emotions, thoughts, being willing to turn towards them and practice with that and feel that, and if that makes sense. Yes, yeah, exactly. And also just to say that it's possible to develop samadhi on changing objects. You know, so there's one, you know, one style of meditation where it's real one-pointed, another style where you're, that's the receptivity I talked about. It's open, it's everything's coming and going, but you're here, you're present, you're not distracted, you're, you know, and okay, so now that I've thoroughly confused you, just to close by saying that what's that line? 90% of life is just showing up. you know, and it's like 99% of this practice is just showing up, you know, just showing up for ourselves and not getting caught up with the technicalities, being a compassionate witness for our own experience is the most important thing. And so maybe we could just sit 1 minute and let the words float away.